This episode was recorded in the summer of 2024.
Peace or justice, engagement or sanctions, neutrality or impartiality, these and many other moral dilemmas are at the heart of the little-known work of conflict mediators. In today's fragmented, multipolar world marked by international tensions and escalating regional conflicts, peacemaking has become an ever more complex and sometimes dangerous process. So what's next for peacemakers in these turbulent times? Welcome to Afterwards. I'm Victor Mallet, a senior editor on the Financial Times World Desk, and joining me today is Pierre Hazan, author and senior advisor with the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva. Pierre has spent decades in the world of back-channel mediation, advising NGOs, governments, and even armed groups on justice, amnesty, reparation, truth commissions, forced disappearances, international humanitarian law, and human rights. And his latest book, Negotiating with the Devil, is an insightful and vivid insider account of the high-stakes process of conflict mediation. In it, Pierre traces the evolution of the role of a peace negotiator and offers a moral compass for mediators whose field of action is being transformed dramatically. So I want to start with a fairly personal question. What kind of a job is it? Is it a satisfying job, or does it take a toll on your conscience and your personal life? And how different is it from, say, being a reporter, which I think you were before for the French newspaper Libération? So what kind of a life does a mediator lead, like yourself?
I was a journalist for a very long time, for 20 years. And one day I was asked to join a mediation organization, which I did. And I found it fascinating. And it's true that sometimes it's highly frustrating because you are just a tiny piece in a very complex situation. So if the people don't want to make peace, you are not going to make it because it's very cold at the very end. In the same time, you are still an element which can help. So the question is, what is the best approach to make this small difference, which can make sometimes a difference for life and death for some people? The other thing also is you meet incredible people, people who are taking risks for their own lives. And here I would like to mention local mediators. Very often the image, the media are focusing on international mediators, but also the people who are taking the more risks are the local mediators, because very often they are being perceived as spies or traitors from their own community. So I think we need to be very, very humble in what we do and still hope to make a small difference.
And just tell us, you mentioned briefly that after 20 years of journalism, you went into mediation. Was that to do with your experience in Bosnia? Or what exactly happened there that made you decide that conflict mediation was the right way for you to go?
Well, actually, it was a phone call at midnight when someone asked me if I wanted to join an organization doing mediation. So I didn't really look for it. But when I found it, when I started working in it, I found it totally fascinating. Coming back to Bosnia, Bosnia for me was like a school, a laboratory, an awful laboratory, because suddenly I found very, very difficult situation. I think a lot of people who are more or less more than 40 years old can remember the ethnic cleansing policy at the time, the war crimes, the policy of rapes and all of that. So to be in the middle of that situation, you realize what a civil war is and how difficult is the work of third parties. Should the third party be part of an ethnic cleansing policy in order to save life? On the one hand, you are basically complicit of a war crime because forced deportation of people is a war crime, but at the same time, you are saving lives. So being part of this type of dilemma of terrible situation, terrible choices, made you think about what's the price of peace? How do you mitigate violence and make the most valid choices?
Yeah, and a very, very difficult decisions that those must be. Can you tell us how your experience, or how, you know, mediation has changed over the years? We have sort of moved, and you mentioned this in your book, we have moved from a situation where we had a sort of more or less unipolar world with the US superpower more or less unchallenged on the global stage. And now we have a much more fragmented situation with China rising, Russia resurgent, aggressively resurgent under Vladimir Putin, and all kinds of other medium-sized powers competing for influence, and all kinds of militant groups, you know, sometimes numbering in the dozens in places like the Eastern Congo and in Sudan. You know, how do you perceive those changes, and how has it changed the work of mediators? I guess in some ways it's made it more difficult because there isn't a sort of clear controller of the global stage, so to speak, which was the United States. But maybe in some ways it's made it easier. I don't know. You tell me.
Well, the field of mediation has changed dramatically. In the 90s, mediation was associated with peace processes. And we can think of so many situations where mediation was instrumental in creating countries to move to peace or to democracy. And today, it's a very different ballgame, obviously. And geopolitical tensions means that when you have mediation, it doesn't mean that you have a peace process. It's just you have sometimes a very transactional agreement, like the one which happened in Gaza, exchanging in last November a number of hostages, Israeli hostages, versus a ceasefire, or the grain deal between Russia and Ukraine. And you can see in both situations, it was just a very transactional deal. Or both sides are still very much at war to each other. And obviously, Israel wants the end of Hamas, and Hamas wants the end of the state of Israel. So it doesn't mean because there is some mediation ongoing that there will be a peace process. That's the first change. The second change is related to new actors in the field. We have China, which helps to make to resume diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And China was active also in Myanmar between the government and different armed groups to create a ceasefire. We have Turkey, we have Qatar. So we have more of new countries emerging as mediators and less of Switzerland and Norway. Another one is technology. And technology has changed dramatically. Obviously, with artificial intelligence, with hybrid warfare, the world has changed so much that it creates new opportunities for mediation, but new challenges. We need to adapt. We need to create new tools to adapt to new technologies, to a new geopolitical situation. And that's fascinating, but also, I mean, the risks are very high. And it's true that today Europe, and both of us are living in Europe today, is almost co-belligerent in the war between Ukraine and Russia. Defense spending has never been so high. The number of refugees have never been so high. So it means that the risks of more war are getting much more real. And that's also a call for more mediation.
Just to go to one specific conflict that is obviously concerning us all right now, and you did mention Gaza, and in the preface to your book in English for Hearst, you talked a lot about Gaza with a lot of passion, and you were quite critical, I think, of the idea of Qatar as mediators, and I was quite surprised by that. Why were you so critical of the idea of Qatar as a mediator?
No, I'm not so, maybe I wasn't clear enough. No, I think it's quite fascinating, actually. If you remember the 9/11 and the resolution 1373, and the concept was the war on terror, you shouldn't speak to so-called terrorist organizations. But in reality, you do speak with everyone. That's a reality. And I think it's the Americans which actually ask Qatar to host Hamas political headquarters over there in order for Hamas to go to a place which is not Iran, basically.
Yes.
So I think I found it, the role of Qatar, extremely interesting. And I found it also a kind of paradigm shift, because we also see through what's happening in Ukraine and in Gaza that nor Hamas nor the State of Israel have much regard for IHL, International Humanitarian Law, which is also extremely concerning. So there is a contempt for basic rules, and that also tells a lot of the new era we are in. And obviously the fact that you are in a multipolar world makes it much more difficult.
So Pierre, let's get onto the question of Ukraine and Russia, which you mentioned. How do we deal with a situation like this extraordinarily large war on the borders of Western Europe when the superpowers are not in agreement, when Russia and China will veto things they don't like, and the Americans will veto things they don't like, and the UN Security Council appears to be broken? Do you see any sort of way forward for mediating our way out of this war, or will it involve one side or the other just having to win or lose the war?
Wars finish only by two ways, either by a military victory or by a compromise. And it's not the time for both sides to go for a compromise. So I don't see any room for a real peace process at this stage. This being said, we can recall that there have been some agreements between Russia and Ukraine, agreements between exchanges of prisoners through mediation, including mediation, interestingly enough, with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. There have been the grain deal, which has been reconducted twice in order to avoid starvation in some parts of Africa. So that was also something quite significant. We can see that it's far from something we would like to see, a real peace process, but we have seen some attempts to mitigate the situation. That's not enough, but at least something has been done.
On the issue of the Ukraine war, your book is entitled Negotiating with the Devil. President Macron of France came in for a lot of criticism, especially just before the war, when he basically talked a lot to Vladimir Putin, essentially trying to persuade him not to invade Ukraine. And of course, that turned out to be useless. And he came in for a lot of criticism from Poland and other countries for negotiating with the devil, which they said he shouldn't have done. But if we look back in retrospect, was it such a bad thing for him to try to talk to Putin at that point, before Putin invaded or launched his full-scale invasion?
Well, Macron spoke also to Putin after the invasion. The question is not so much to talk or not to talk, is you want to talk with some results, with a plan, with some vision. And I'm afraid it was more of empty words and not with a very deep thought strategy. I think it's good to talk, but I don't think to be blind. And I think one of the challenges for a mediator is to decide when enough is enough.
Enough is enough in terms of negotiating and talking, you mean?
Yes. There have been discussions on Syria for, 12 years now? And I think it's not going anywhere. And, you know, in the beginning, there was Kofi Annan. And after a year, he said, no, I think the two sides are not interested in talks. And he decided to resign. And I can understand that. I think it's wrong for a third party to give an appearance of a peace process when nothing is coming on. And it's just some kind of show or window dressing or PR exercise. And I think it's not helpful, and it's actually could be counterproductive.
You mentioned international humanitarian law, and I have a big question, I think, about whether it actually means anything, or whether international rules and the rules-based order and all these things, whether they are simply rules that are supposedly adhered to and indeed imposed by the dominant power of the day, which previously was the United States, can they actually be resurrected as truly international standards and, you know, formats under which people should operate, under which people, for example, should fight wars or make peace? You seem to be saying that the support or acceptance of international law, international rules, was declining or had disappeared. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the security arrangements post-World War II are vanishing. That's a fact. But I would like also to stress something. It's about international humanitarian law. You may recall that for a very long time, the Soviet Union, not the Russia, the Soviet Union considered Geneva Convention as bourgeois law and as such refused to ratify them. And as a result, a very high percentage of Russian prisoners of Germany died. But oppositely, the vast majority of American and British prisoners remain alive in the hands of Nazi Germany because Nazi Germany respected, at least for the prisoners of war, and I insist that prisoners of war, I'm not talking about civilians and persons who were persecuted, they respected the Geneva Conventions. So I think these laws of war have a real value, but also I understand today they are violated and it's like consideration, but they do have a value to put some limits to the use of force.
And I mean, we've had interesting examples where the US has, you know, which says it is trying to impose or accept international law. But then when the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice makes rulings about Israel or Gaza that it doesn't like, the Americans get all upset about it. I mean, it's slightly bizarre, it seems to me, that Western powers should demand that everyone accepts international law and international rules. But then when those international rules turn out not to be favorable to the West's allies, then they're saying, actually, we don't like these rules at all, and we want to punish the people who are enforcing them.
I think it's very important to come back to history. With Resolution 808, which created the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, there was the concept that justice in a wartime will contribute to peace. And this concept is not true anymore. Law is being used and manipulated by everyone for its own political ends. It's true for the US, you mentioned the US, but it's true for South Africa. South Africa, for instance, ratified the ICC. Did it arrest Omar al-Bashir, who was accused of a crime of genocide when he was in South Africa? No. So you see, everyone is using the tool of international criminal justice to score a political point. So we see the limits of international law. I think it's important to recall that there are norms, there are values, but in the same time, we see that they are being instrumentalized by everyone.
If you look back over your own career, what kind of lessons do you think you've been able to learn from specific conflicts that might surprise our listeners? You know, is there anything where you sort of, you were caught off guard and thought, well, that's interesting, I never thought of that way of looking at things? I mean, you already mentioned that everybody, many people end up talking to terrorists when they say they won't. I mean, maybe the whole concept of the word terrorism is a slightly devalued word when it just means somebody you don't like who's violently pursuing their ends. What kind of lessons do you draw from your work over the years of the way we, almost like the way we frame all these debates about conflict and peacemaking?
Well, so many lessons. I think one of them is the need for a moral compass. Basically, there are a lot of books about wars, a few books about peace, but not many books about wondering about the ethics of a third party, the ethics of a mediator. And, you know, we can recall the attitude of the Red Cross during World War II. We can recall so many things. So I think it's not a light issue. It's a real thing. The second dimension is entering, I believe, in a very difficult era. And we see the world getting to a very dangerous place. And I'm very concerned. And what I learned also is that sometimes there are so many layers which need to be dealt separately. Let me give you, that's very abstract. Let me be very concrete. I worked in the Sahel region, and I thought it was only one conflict with one armed group against the government. I realized that not only that there was this specific conflict, then there was climate change on the top of it, because suddenly people who were herders had to go to more fertile land because they couldn't use the same land as before. So that was creating new type of conflicts. Then you have conflicts between different communities. So what I'm trying to say is the rules of the games are changing, and we need to be very careful about all the evolution, the political evolution, the geopolitical evolution, and also the technological evolution. And we need to deal with specific tools and to adapt them. Because very often, when you look at the UN in the 90s, the strategy was basically like the supermarkets, IKEA, you know, cut and paste. And you go from one place and you use the same tools for another place. And it's not going to work. And too many times there have been no adaptation. And I think it's very important to look very, very carefully to the social and political dynamism of each society and try to work with this society and understand deeply the fabrics of this society. And it's only through that type of work, I believe, you can reach some results. Obviously, on a big scale, that's another ball game, but it has to be tackled also very concretely at the local level. And don't forget that 50% of peace agreements are failing within 5 or 10 years. And why so? They are failing because they are not being inclusive enough. They have been just elite deals, and huge part of society have been left outside of these elite deals. So it's very important to be much more inclusive. That requires, again, civil society adaptation and adjustment to very local situation.
I want to come back to the issue of peace versus justice that we talked about right at the beginning. You know, justice is obviously, you know, the imposition of laws that are supposedly enforcing the correct path on people or societies or countries. And peace is obviously a sort of vaguer concept that essentially means the absence of war. And in your work, you and the people you negotiate with are always having to make these rather complicated, morally difficult compromises. And I was struck by, I think you quoted David Harland as saying there's a hierarchy of rights, by which he meant that, you know, the right to justice can be deferred to later on in a few years' time or a few months' time, but the right to life cannot, because if you don't confer the right to life immediately, somebody dies. Is that something that you sort of, that complex compromise you have to deal with every day when you're doing these kind of negotiations?
I think it's too dramatic, too binary. I think the concept of justice should be unpacked. Because justice is not only criminal justice, it's restorative justice, it's reparation, it's acknowledgement, it's memorialization. So if you start to unpack it, suddenly you have a lot of tools you can use in order to inject in a peace process. So the question is not just peace or no justice, is what kind of justice mechanisms I can insert at a certain point in time, and then continue to insert when times will enable to do so. So it's more a sequential approach and a much broader understanding of the concept of justice. And in the same time, the concept of peace, one definition of peace, which is basically the one you mentioned, it's negative peace, it's just the end of hostilities. And then you have positive peace, which is something quite different, which is the concept that you are not only killing each other, but you are trying to resolve your differences through peaceful means. So I think we need to have a more broader understanding of these concepts.
I was in old Manila the other day in the Philippines, and there's a memorial there to the 100,000 people who were killed in the final days of the war by the Japanese, but also by Americans, American bombardment. They were trying to get the Japanese out of Manila at the end of the Second World War. And it made me realize that a huge number of people died in a very short space of time, civilians we're talking about, not just soldiers. And it made me realize that actually there is the possibility of reconciliation. You know, the Filipinos are still talking to the Japanese. The Japanese are investing in the Philippines. It's the same with Vietnam and the Americans. There is a surprising lack of overt hostility between the two peoples, despite the massive conflict that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. So I kind of brings me to perhaps my penultimate question is, are you kind of very pessimistic at the moment, given all the conflicts we have? Or are you, do you think that ultimately we can work our way through all these conflicts that are occupying us right now?
Well, we don't have a planet B. I mean, there is no choice. We need to deal with the situation as it is today and that it will be tomorrow. And I see also rays of hope. I see civil society playing a much bigger role. I think the time of just the elite trying to deal and make short-term decisions is not enough, because the challenges are getting global. And when you think about what happened in Paris regarding the climate, you can see that sometimes countries can unite in order to make some positive steps. Obviously, it's not enough. It's never enough. But still a step in the right direction. I think it's very important to continue.
Thank you so much, Pierre. Now, we finish every show by asking our guest about one source or text. It could be a film or a book or something else that influenced your book. What was the source or the text that influenced you the most when you came to write this book?
Well, I guess it was Charlie Chaplin, The Great Dictator.
Ah, wow. that's a good one.
You know, the film was released in 1940. It's amazing. And Chaplin had huge difficulties to produce it. No one wants that film. And I think it was, you know, visionary at the time. And I think it's extremely relevant today. And I think, you know, with humor, you can still tackle very serious questions. And it was such a warning. And so it was so visionary. That's the one I would choose. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Pierre. That's a great note to end on. We should all keep our sense of humor in these difficult days. Thank you so much to Pierre Hazan. And you can buy a copy of his book, Negotiating with the Devil, from the Hearst Publishers website. Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. For more, follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers, Pierre at Pierre_Hazan, and me at VJ Mallet on Twitter. And to get news of the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Victor Mallet. Thank you very much for listening.